it's just amazing. This little light, this little candle, this little flicker of hope that from the basement that I thought maybe, just maybe, maybe my life could be used for something greater than me if I can make it through this. And, you know, back in that basement, Whit, I cried daily, not in the basement necessarily. I would go for long winter walks. And I remember the snow sometimes would be up to my knees and I had insufficient boots and it was cold. And I would just cry, not crying because I was sad or not crying because there was really emotion. I would just be needing to release. I had never released before in my life. And to know that the crying might have been the reason why the candle stayed lit. And that eventually that flicker would turn into a flame and that flame would turn into Imaloa. If you had told me back then what I know now, I wouldn't have believed you, but I'm certainly grateful that I hung on.
This is Unconditioning, discovering the voice within, with Whitney Ann Jenkins.
Hello and welcome to the 59th episode of Unconditioning, Discovering the Voice Within, where I bring on guests and we talk about the inner authentic voice and the challenges and the rewards that come from following it. This week, I have with me Jake Sasseville. Jake is a serial media, music, and hospitality entrepreneur, author, and podcaster. He is the CEO and founder of Imaloa Institute in Costa Rica and was the youngest host in late-night TV history on ABC, and the White House named him one of the most innovative entrepreneurs under 30. Imaloa Institute is booked years in advance, and his clients renew at a rate of 86%. Inc. magazine wrote that Jake has more than enough chutzpah to scale any business, and Huffington Post wrote that he's built an impactful career at the intersection of culture and consciousness. This is probably one of my favorite podcasts that I've done so far. Jake was an incredible guest. He has so much energy and charisma and wisdom and just a beautiful heart in sharing his truth and allowing other people to find a space that they're able to explore their truth at a deeper level and their consciousness and create more awareness in this world, which is so needed. I know that every second of this podcast was delightful for me, and I can only hope that it's the same for you. And Jake even offers a special offer to the listeners at the end of this podcast. So be sure to stick around for the entire thing. And without any further explanation from me, here is Jake Sasseville.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You too. So you have been on quite a journey in your life already. You've had to go through a lot yourself. There's something that I find that has driven me in my life, and people who have achieved certain things follow this inner voice or the authentic voice or their intuition. And so I'm wondering, when is the first time that you realized that you had this inner voice of your own?
What a phenomenal way to start out our conversation. That is so beautiful. Thank you for that question. And thanks for having me on your podcast. You know, it's a great question, Whit, because I think that when we learn to cultivate and listen to life's whisper, and we learn to live life on life's terms, the greatest possibilities start to open. And I would have thought 15 years ago, that sounds like a bunch of woo-woo nonsense.
Right.
But yeah. Now I've seen not only how good my life has become, because I think a lot of people define their lives by how good it is or how much access to material things they have. Mm-hmm. And that's not what it is. That's partly what it is for me. Like, obviously I like to live in a comfortable house. I have a nice car, even though I live in Costa Rica, and having a comfortable car is nice. But my focus is not on the amassing of those things. And I think partly it's because of my introduction to awareness and consciousness and learning more about listening to the whisper. So it's interesting. The first time that I ever recognized that I could hear or experience something other than my own monkey mind was when I was 21. I had traveled to London to my someone who became a very dear friend and mentor, Susie Pearl. And Susie Pearl at that time was a big shot PR exec, spiritually curious, managing director of all these companies, and had done Madonna's publicity and Michael Jackson's publicity. And so it really done the thing with culture, the whole culture kind of hamster wheel. And she was really diving in more at that point to spirituality and consciousness. And she was just starting to write books that would become best-selling books. And so I was 21, starting my first TV show, about to launch after Jimmy Kimmel on ABC, becoming the youngest host in late night TV. And intuitively, I knew I had to spend more time with people like Susie. So I went to London for Thanksgiving. I remember this in 2007, in Chiswick in West London. And she had a whole library of meditation books and CDs. And I remember seeing Paul McKenna's meditation CD. Paul McKenna's a hypnotist in the UK. And it was so ironic because he happened to be over for Thanksgiving that night. She had like a Thanksgiving meal to honor the token American. And so all of a sudden this guy who's like a worldwide hypnotist is having Thanksgiving with us, and I have his book and CD, and I did his meditation. And it was the first time that I had ever meditated. Wow. Like on CD. And I like went somewhere, didn't go asleep. I went somewhere and then I came back here, but I had been somewhere. And wherever I had gone, it had gotten me to calm down and listen to what's in between sentences and in between words, part of whatever is in the ether. So that was really the first time that when I was 21, that really cracked me open and showed me that there's something else here.
Yeah. You said that you felt like you needed to surround yourself by people like Susie. And so that statement in itself kind of like is a testament to you following your voice, maybe before you even recognized that you were doing so.
Totally. I had a lot of crazy people around me. I was in the entertainment business. I had a team that was often double and triple my age. I was only 20 at the time. And so something inside of me, I started dealing with life's biggest questions at an early age, seeking answers. My brother died when I was 17 in my parents' arms. He was 13. You know, my dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's. My mom's an alcoholic. Like, what is life and why am I here? And why don't I feel secure in my own home? And some of these huge questions that a 15, 16, 17-year-old is not really often answering or asking rather, or getting answers to, but I was, so I knew that I had to search for answers. And luckily, you know, I used my age to my advantage. 20-year-old calls you up and wants to have a spiritual conversation with you. You know, I don't care how busy you are. You're probably, if you're a spiritual seeker yourself, you're probably going to take a minute or two. And so I used that to my advantage. And I would travel around the world to visit authors whose books I had read and just wanted to be with them and wanted to learn from them. And so I did that all throughout my 20s. And it was a nice contrast to my crazy life in New York City, which was often filled with high highs and low lows. And yet in between those storms, I was seeking out serenity. I was seeking out the calm in between storms with these people that became my friends and my teachers.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. So you said that when you did the guided meditation, that you went somewhere else. Can you describe that experience?
Yeah, I haven't thought in detail about that in probably a decade, but I would say what I got, well, I now have the words because I've studied about what happened, but you know, we have four, some would say five brainwave states. You and I are talking, we're probably in the beta brainwave. Then below that, there's alpha, which is like when you're just waking up in the morning, you're in an alpha brainwave. Then you have theta, which is your dream state. And then you have delta, which is deep sleep. Yeah. Basically, I mean, there's a fifth one too that some people argue, which is gamma above beta, which is where we are now. But anyways, what I experienced, the scientific explanation of what I experienced was I basically went into conscious deep delta. So I went into conscious sleep. And I had never done that before. I had either been asleep or been awake. Like I had never recognized that there was a way to go into like a deep state of conscious awareness. And so that's what I can liken it to. It was peace. I couldn't feel my body. I couldn't really hear things besides the guided meditation. It was as if I was in a void of nothingness and yet everything was there that I needed. Didn't really notice my breath. And I was just able to see things. And I started to become very intuitive in those states as well. And then I recognized as I studied more about remote viewing and remote influencing, the stuff that the CIA uses, that I learned later that the CIA uses. These are states that you can actually access through training and that I had started to access. So we all have access to it. It's just a matter of training the mind to be able to get there. And, you know, I could have gone down a different path with it all, of course, because it's kind of a nefarious, it's like, oh, this is the stuff that they don't want you to know. For me, I just used it to be able to chill out and calm myself down and recognize that there was more to life than what I was experiencing.
Yeah. So when you have an experience like that, there can be a desire to perhaps like chase that state of being.
Yes.
So how did you, after having that experience, find a way to get back there again without trying to so hard?
The truth is, this is such good. I mean, this is why I love doing different interviews, because these conversations are just so good. It's a great question. And the answer is, I started to get hooked for like a 3 or 4 month period. I would go and live in London with Susie for 3 or 4 months at a time. And I remember one time I was reading a book called Parallel Universes of the Infinite Self by Frederick Dodson, who's written 26 books on, probably more now, but back then 26 books on parallel universes and reality creation and all of this. And I remember reading I could only read 2 or 3 pages of the book at a time, Parallel Universes. And I remember I read the chapter or started to read the chapter on time travel. And I had experienced a moment when I time traveled. I went into a meditation at 5:15 in the evening. I set my timer for 45 minutes because I knew that I would have to be up at 6 to go in to dinner with Susie. And I woke up or came out of the sleep session at 5 o'clock. I thought it was 5 o'clock the next morning, but it wasn't. I thought maybe I had slept 24 hours, but I hadn't. And so for some reason, the clock had gone, or the time that I had experienced had gone from 5:15 to 5. So I basically came out of it 15 minutes earlier than when I had went into it. Now that might sound crazy, and it would to me too, but it's what happened when I was 21, 22. So I started chasing this stuff. I was like, oh, this is good. And then it stopped working. Mm-hmm. The minute I started chasing it. And to be honest with you, I haven't time traveled since then. I can't believe I'm talking about time travel on a podcast. This is great. But I haven't experienced that since then. So like when I started to access things, because we're 20, right? I was in my early 20s. And so it's like, ooh, I want more of that. It became a little bit like a drug.
Right, yeah.
But as I desired it more, the further away it went. And yeah, and I just learned to accept that. Now I just meditate for the quality of the meditation and the quality of the experience. Yeah.
So you went from, so after that period of time that you were with Susie, what happened next for you?
Oh my gosh, that's such a broad question. Susie was the soft landing to what was often very heroic failures. So I would have a show that would launch, and then I would go $250,000 in debt and have to consider bankruptcy. And then I would come back from that after a year, and then something would fall apart. And in between those massive career free falls, I would run to the UK to be with Susie, just to learn, you know, just kind of charging myself for the next one. And then, you know, I really had my moment, my rock bottom moment when I was 27. My house got washed away in Hurricane Sandy in New York City. My TV contracts all got canceled. My friends started to no longer speak with me because I had become a really kind of difficult person. Maniacal, I would say. I'd become maniacal. Some would even say megalomaniacal. And so I had to move from New York City, where my whole life was, because I didn't have anything. Money was drying up. And I had to move back in with my grandma in grandma's basement in Lewiston, Maine, in the middle of the winter. And I told grandma, I said, grandma, I'll just be there for a month. And I ended up being there for 2 years. And it was a sustained spiritual awakening. So I had had moments, I had had glimmers, I had had meditations, I had had teachers, I had had interesting experiences, but now I was going to have to face myself. And it kind of goes back to what I said at the top of the show, which is learning to live life on life's terms. Right. That's what I got in that basement. I got that I could create from a place of surrender instead of hustle, that I didn't need to hustle or use people in order to be creative. And I couldn't have gotten that unless I was looking at 4 walls of a basement and snow outside with nothing going on and the phone no longer ringing. I had to be put into surrender in order to be able to accept the surrender. And it was very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's one thing to have those experiences like separately off, like in a place that you have experiences like that. It's another thing to integrate them into your life and have them be a part of your daily existence.
Totally. And I think luckily I had stumbled into and then started working a 12-step program. So that gave me a framework for what I was experiencing a bit, or how I could take action to have a practice for what I was experiencing. Because it's hard. A lot of people are trying to transform their lives. They're coming to retreats like the retreat center that we run here in Costa Rica. They are following people online. They are trying to introduce practices into their life. They're trying to eat clean. It's very hard to choose a new way of life, to choose a new uncharted way when you still have everyday life going on around you. And so even though Grandma's Basement, 2 years of it, was some of the hardest moments of my life, because all my self-worth, remember, you know, there's a quote by Wayne Dyer, if you are what you do, then when you don't, you aren't. If you are what you do, then when you don't, you aren't. It's as if when I didn't have my TV shows and my people, you know, coming and working for me and all of this, and if I wasn't creating something that I was shipping, if I wasn't compulsively hustling, it was as if I literally ceased to exist. So my ego died a very slow, miserable death in that basement because everything ceased to exist as I knew it. But that's what got me to start opening up to how life could be, deal with life in a whole different way, because suddenly I didn't have the distraction of work or teams or drama or fundraising because the phone wasn't ringing, the snow started flying, and I was literally looking at me, myself, and I with a dog, and Grandma, thank God, was putting food in the fridge and gas in the car, so I had a little bit of freedom. Actually, I had a whole lot of freedom. I'll tell you, I was never happier. Even now, I'm very fulfilled right now. I love my life in Costa Rica, but I was never happier than when I had nothing in that basement because I had nothing to lose, everything to gain. And I was fully present with life in a way like I haven't been since. And it was really special.
Yeah. So you said that you were there for 2 years. So how long did it take you to be able to accept your situation and surrender to the idea of being there and facing?
So there were a few mile markers that happened along that route. So the first year I resisted it. Friends would buy me bus tickets to New York and I would schlep to New York so that I could date, right? Because I wasn't going to date anybody in Maine. That's for damn sure. And no offense to anybody in Maine. I love being from Maine. Where are you from? What state are you from?
I grew up in West Virginia, so...
Okay, so you understand what it's like to date people in West Virginia, yes or yes?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I understand. I understand.
Actually, there's a TikTok person that's from West Virginia that I used to be obsessed with. I had to get off of TikTok. I'm totally getting off subject. Baylin Dupree. I don't know if you know who Baylin Dupree is.
I'm gonna confess something that I don't engage in TikTok at all, so I'm not sure.
Well, I'll tell you right now that I had to get off of TikTok because I was getting up at 4 a.m. in the morning just to scroll through TikTok. And I thought, this is a problem. So I had to completely get off the air. I actually am off social media now for a year. Right now for my birthday, I got off of social media for a year just to see if I could do that. Anyways, back to your question, which is how did I know? So I would be dating in New York. I would be visiting friends in New York. I was starting and failing at five. I started and failed at five businesses that first year in the basement. And so the reason why I'm sharing those three things with you and your audience, Whitney, is because that was how my resistance played out, right? My resistance to not accepting what was by trying to create stuff, trying to date people, trying to compulsively travel so that I didn't have to actually face my situation. Meanwhile, I was asking my friends to pay for it all. And like, you know, because I had no money, I had no opportunities, I had no jobs, and I was starting and failing at five businesses. It was in the second year that I started to let go. I didn't keep traveling to New York. I started to cultivate a community life in Lewiston, Maine, where I had grown up and resisted being from for so long. And it started to really, something just clicked for me. It was after doing the 12 steps, I was sponsoring others in my 12-step program. I found tremendous joy doing little community activities and service projects. I started a podcast. Grandma didn't have internet, so I started a podcast in a Dunkin' Donuts parking lot in her car that ended up with 250,000 downloads a month after just 3 months. And I ended up making a ton of money from that podcast, like 10, 12,000 a month. At the time, it was a lot of money because, first of all, it was a podcast in 2013. Like, what the F? And second of all, I was just literally talking to people from my grandma's 2004 Jetta in a Dunkin' Donuts parking lot. Like, right. What? So, but that was the second year. That's when I had essentially surrendered. And I think a lot of people think that surrender is like giving up. For me, it's just about turning over. It's just about letting go and letting God, the God of my understanding. I don't want it to be difficult for people to listen to the G-O-D word, but these ideas of that we learn in our 12-step program, my 12-step program, just about higher power and the higher power of your understanding. As I stopped trying to exert my own self-will over situations, which is what I had done in the first year in the basement, finally started to let go. And I finally started to say, okay, show me where I should go, who I should call, who you would have me be.
Yeah. You're not putting so much pressure on yourself, but allowing someone else to
step
in. Yeah.
So much of my misery and difficulty, even though I was often applauded for my incredible courage, was because I was just fueled on my own self-will. And that can only go so far. People don't realize that. People in their 30s and 40s and 50s, they might be still on their self-will train, but that eventually, you know, that can only go for so long if you actually want to be fulfilled and aligned in life. That's what I believe anyways. Doesn't mean you don't work hard. I mean, I'm probably working harder in my life than I ever have, but I'm not doing it for the results. I'm doing it because of the thrill of taking action. I'm in the action taking business now, not the results business.
Right. Yeah. And you're operating from a place of alignment too within that, it seems like. My only job,
I believe, when I'm out of alignment is just find a way to get back into alignment. Find a way to feel the relief in life, whatever it is, even if it's taking a nap, like just get back into it.
Yeah, for sure. And so what year was this basement Dark Night of the Soul experience?
That's exactly what it was, a Dark Night of the Soul. It was from 2013. I went in July of 2013 and I came out August of 2015.
All right. So
it was 2 years and a month.
Okay. So having that experience, and what got you out of that basement in particular?
You know, there was a moment where I just accepted that I would never leave the basement. There was a moment when I said, this is my new life. I'm living with my grandmother till she dies and life is done for me. And I had accepted it because acceptance is the key to all of my issues today. Mm-hmm. So once I accepted that, that's when life started to change. That's when the podcast started to take off. And then I was trying to figure out where I would go and live. And I didn't know where I was going, right? Because New York and LA did not feel conducive to me any longer after going through this massive spiritual awakening. Mm-hmm. And so my friend was like, well, you loved Maui when you came to my wedding. I was like, you think I'm going to move to Maui? I mean, that's the most expensive island in the world. I'm in a basement in the middle of a mill town in Maine. Okay. And she's like, take action, turn the results over. Cause that's what I was always saying, right? I was like, oh, I'm in the action taking business. So I found a house. I applied for a house on Maui. It's a big old house, 4,000 square feet. My plan was that I would Airbnb the cottage out back and live in a big old main house and just enjoy life on Maui. I didn't know what I was going to do. Anyways, I applied for this house. I had no business applying for it. I had about a 500 credit score. I mean, I was deep into it. Even though I was starting to make money again, I didn't show a lot of money on previous tax returns, owed the IRS a whole lot as well. And the property manager called me back 2 weeks later and she said, you can have the house if you want it. I was like, what? Is this how life works? That I can just have what I want if I want it? Like, if you want it, you can have the house if you want it. It was just such a testimony to me at the time. You know, I was like, oh, this is how things work. This is pretty cool. Yeah. And so, 3 weeks later, I moved from grandma's basement to Kula, Hawaii, which I woke up the first morning and I went for a walk and I saw Oprah and Gail. And I was like, okay, I went from grandma's basement to Oprah's neighbor. That's interesting. That was a little surreal. And I ended up spending 3 years on Maui. Never thought I would leave. And, you know, I ran the Airbnb in the backyard, which was great. It paid for the whole house for the whole 3 years. It was never empty. And as people came to visit me in the main house, I realized that people really want to feel at home in whatever transformational activity they're doing. My house became a space for people to transform their lives, come and, you know, I never charged people. I just invited people. I ended up having hundreds, if not thousands of people to my house over 3 years. And that's where the seed for my next venture would start. So it was all just by taking action, turning the results over. It sounds ridiculous saying it, but it's totally true.
Yeah. Yeah. Following your intuition and your internal guide, your voice, your,
yeah.
Yeah. And unconditioning from the structures that you were a part of for so long.
And by the way, not listening too closely with people who had adverse reactions to it. Because when I started doing this, people were like, I'm sorry, what? And yeah, it's just, and it's not like I had to prove them wrong. I didn't want to get into a situation where I was proving people right or wrong again, because that's how I had done life. But it's just taking calm, steady action despite all that.
Yeah. And creating a protection and boundaries around yourself and your dreams.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So the time on Maui, what did you learn like that affected you the most, do you think, from your Maui days?
I had been taught how to fail for years. I had not been taught how to succeed. I had been taught how to live paycheck to paycheck and within my means. I had not taught what it looks like to live abundantly or profitably. I remember my parents, I mean, you don't know this, but my parents made $20,000, $30,000 a year. I mean, we were lower to middle income. We lived on the wrong side of the tracks when I grew up. Money was not seen as something that was even possible. Like, it was just like, yeah, it was such an anomaly for going to New York, wanting to be in television. I don't know where I got all that from. Probably a whole lot of pain somewhere deep down, trying to turn my pain into purpose, as I say now, but I'm just trying to make sense of it all. But I think what I learned there was how, what I learned in Maui specifically, I remember because I had breakdowns over this. People might think this is ridiculous, but I lived in such a gorgeous house in such a gorgeous neighborhood on such a gorgeous island that I had beauty around me all the time. The smells, the views, the people, the music, it was like sensory overload of like gorgeousness. And I had a really hard time accepting that. No one ever taught me how to accept abundance. And I don't even like that word because it sounds so woo-woo, but you know, I was earning, I wasn't working for it. I mean, I had the Airbnb, like I was kind of working, but I was like learning how to put systems in place that would cause me to be abundant rather than me working my bum off for it. So I would say that's probably the biggest thing I learned. I learned literally, I just remember looking outside my front porch in Maui. It was 306 or 180 degrees looking at three Hawaiian islands from 3,000 feet up. And it was like infathomable that I lived there after I was in a basement. Unbelievable. And I remember just crying and I was like, why am I crying? So I would call my friend in Australia and she would talk me through and just point out what was happening. It was like really, it was learning how to accept it. And I know that sounds ridiculous. Like, oh, look at the privileged white guy who had to learn to accept his abundance. Like, okay, fine. People can have that. Cause I know I have that story running. Like, why does it take, but if you're not taught how to do that, it takes real practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a journey.
And I feel like it's also a reflection of your own self value and your own self-worth and being able to accept it and think that you deserve
to be in and to know that I was powerful and I was one with God,
right?
You know, that it's like I don't need to hide from the power that I have. I just need to not let my self-will run amok. You know, I just need to keep it in check. The way I keep it in check is through daily practices, through conscious contact with God. You know, these things that maybe we don't learn enough about when we're growing up, about like how to have relationship with spirit or higher power, how to be really quiet. And
so you planted that seed. You had hundreds of people coming to you in your place that was surrounded by beauty, and so that had a ripple effect to where you are now, I'm guessing.
I would say so. One thing I identified, very good setup by the way, Whit. Where I really got to was recognizing that and I kind of said this before, but people want to feel at home in their transformation. And so I had never been to a retreat center. I had never been to a retreat. I had been to hotels. I had started an Airbnb. I'm not a hospitality person. I'm a college dropout at this point, right? Still am, you know, but I decide that I'm going to start taking action toward creating a retreat center. And that retreat center would eventually be called Imaloa. And it was named by a Hawaiian elder who found out the vision of leading human beings from a spirit of service and a posture of learning, reconnecting humanity with its head, from its head to its heart, doing so through the vision of an intercontinental institute. One on every continent is the original vision of Imaloa. The woman who named Imaloa, she said, what you're speaking of is Imaloa. She was a Hawaiian woman. And Imaloa literally translates into exploration driven by a sense of wonder and imagination. Exploration driven by a sense of wonder and imagination. And that animated the path. And it took 3 years for Imaloa to be. And I thought it was going to be in Hawaii. Me and an ex-business partner raised the money. It didn't get greenlit in Hawaii. The next continent was always Central America. So within 40 days, I had made an offer on a top of a mountain, 4 hours away from the capital. I had gone back to Hawaii, the capital of Costa Rica, I had gone back to Hawaii, liquidated my 4,000 square foot home in 30 days, 40 days. And then all at once, June 1st, 2018, moved to Costa Rica and built what would become Imaloa in the middle of the jungle on top of a mountain at the end of a road out on the edge of a cliff. And it is gorgeous.
It sounds like it. You're going back to your roots in the middle of nowhere, right?
you're referring to Maine? In some ways,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I ain't in the basement anymore, Dorothy, but that's an interesting thing. No one's ever brought that before. I think, there's definitely qualities in the jungle that remind me of the basement, to be very honest with you. And in the way that it reflects back to people, when you're in this amount of nature, the way that it reflects back to you, what you're most unwilling or unable to look at, those do have the qualities of the basement. That was very insightful. Thanks for that, Whit.
Absolutely. So you opened in 2018. So that was before all of COVID and everything.
Yeah. That was an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to talk about it?
I mean, if you want to.
You have the quality of some of my favorite podcasters where you just will make a comment and then just stay quiet and then wait for the other person to see if they're going to say anything. It's kind of fun, actually. I never know whether I should talk or just let you say something else. So the COVID was interesting. So we opened in 2018. We had only 5 retreats in the first 8 months. Like, it was hard. Like, we were building, we were $1 million over budget. Thank God we had such patient investors. It was a lot to open a space like this in a foreign country, for me especially, because I'm not from here and I'm very clear that I'm not from here. And so I wanted to respect the culture and values, but I also wanted to build something really beautiful. So I had to build something really beautiful alongside Costa Ricans. And so that means I had to really learn a culture that it was very foreign to me.
Right.
And I had the best teachers. I mean, some of the best teachers here are my team that are still with me and still with Imaloa and really helped shape Imaloa into what it is today. So during COVID, the borders shut in Costa Rica for 7 months. Imaloa was the only place to stay open and not fire a soul in the hospitality business. And I think that's a function of when your vision is big enough and when your heart is in the right place and you have a whole lot of luck. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not taking any credit for not, you know, it was because of the generosity of the investors and the team that took massive pay cuts, including myself. I took a 90% pay cut just so we could stay open. The team took, you know, 75 to 90% pay cuts just to stay open. I mean, it was a really difficult time, but we stayed open and we pivoted to being a space that people could live and work from. So we turned into a live and work for 12 months, 13 months. And that's what got us by. That and some generous investors and a generous team. And, you know, now we're, thanks be to God, sold out for a year and a half, almost 2 years. You know, retreats are booking into 2024, back to back to back to back to back to back to back. Like literally, I came here yesterday to Imaloa and we had a checkout at 2 p.m. and a check-in at 4 p.m. Group of 30 leaving, group of 25 coming in. Every day it's like that for the next year. Every week it's like that, rather, for the next year. It's just amazing. This little light, this little candle, this little flicker of hope that from the basement that I thought maybe, just maybe my life could be used for something greater than me if I can make it through this. And, you know, back in that basement, Whit, I cried daily, not in the basement necessarily. I would go for long winter walks in a bird sanctuary called Thorns Crag. And I remember the snow sometimes would be up to my knees and I had insufficient boots and it was cold. And I would just cry, not crying because I was sad or not crying because there was really emotion. I would just be needing to release. I had never released before in my life. And to know that the crying might have been the reason why the candle stayed lit. And that eventually that flicker would turn into a flame. And that flame would turn into Imaloa. If you had told me back then what I know now, I wouldn't have believed you, but I'm certainly grateful that I hung on.
Yeah, absolutely. Allowing yourself to like go through it rather than dance around it.
Because I had danced for 27 years. I could do the boogie right around any sort of issue. And I was great at avoiding. And I was also great at appearing to take things head on. But really, I was just a scared kid. And until I really went through it, or when I really went through it, that's when life started to open up for me.
Yeah. Congratulations on all of that and being where you are now. To get to where you are now, that took a lot of courage for you to go through that.
Thank you, Whitney.
Yes. And I'm curious because you were talking about when you were in Maui and you were saying on Maui. So is that the proper way to say it? You were on Maui?
On Maui. Yeah. I think that's how people say it. Yeah. On Maui or in Hawaii.
Okay. So you said that you were surrounded by this beauty and you were having a hard time accepting it when you were there, but now you're in an equally beautiful place, I imagine. Mm-hmm. How are you accepting where you are now?
Again, phenomenal questions. So my path to acceptance in Costa Rica was very different than my path to acceptance in Maui. Maui, I started to learn that life could happen beautifully, that I didn't need to struggle in order to enjoy life. That was important. In Costa Rica, I hid from my brightest light, from being my brightest light, because I had two business partners that stepped down out of the company in 2020 during COVID that almost sank the company. Not because they necessarily stepped down, but because I was not equipped or thought I wasn't equipped to step in as CEO, which is ironic because anyone that I told that I was stepping in as CEO, they said, oh, I thought you already were. So everyone else had seen me as this really powerful figure at Imaloa. But really, I just saw myself as the sales guy visionary. So I was just closing the contracts and envisioning what would be possible. I hadn't stepped into my real power. Mm-hmm. And so the acceptance, what I needed to learn to accept here was actually that. It was my own personal power. It was my own bright light that was unimaginable to me. It was my ability to lead the company. You know, it was equivalent to a plane careening toward a mountain during COVID and getting that plane not only stabilized with everybody safe, but then back up to 30,000 feet over the last 2 years. Took some real soul searching because I said no three times to the investors when they asked me to step in as CEO. I was like, I am not the CEO. They're like, either that or we sell it. And I was like, okay, I'm the CEO. Because the dream, right? The dream was still there. The fire was still there. The flicker was still there. And I had dealt with the basement. So I felt I could deal with anything, including a global pandemic in the tourism business in a developing country. Huh, interesting amount of variables against you there.
Right.
So I would say just accepting my own ability, because I had spent so much time in my 12-step program experiencing and just exploring my own powerlessness to really change anything about my life. And now I was in a situation where I had to depend on my own, ability, you know, I don't even know if it's ability, but capacity. I had to build my capacity to show up for others in a way like I never had before. And it really transformed the way that I look at building businesses. I would say before COVID, I had secretly believed that I was the X factor in everything that I did. And I recognized the divinity and possibility of what a well-oiled machine known as a team, when the team is well incentivized, not just financially, but when it's a safe space, when there's personal and professional development happening, when it really is from a place of we instead of me, when there are core values that are leading decisions like hiring, firing, promoting, and different decision-making within the company, that transforms, first of all, the pressure on a CEO. And second of all, it transforms the trajectory for a company and what's possible for that company. So that's what I had to learn to accept and recognize in Costa Rica.
Well, that's not nothing.
That's not nothing. And it's a great question because, you know, one of the things that I've been really toying with, Whitney, is moving away from the grandma's basement story in the conversations that I have, because it's such a grounding thing for me. Literally, I was in a basement, but that's so in the past now for me. That's right. Almost 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And what's more recent is what you just asked about in terms of Costa Rica and stepping into my light there, or, you know, my capacity there. So I thank you so much because that's causing me to reflect about how I want to show up in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Accepting your light and not letting it be diminished by those who are around you to be conditioned, right? Because we can recognize our light, but to take it out there into the world is quite another task.
And by the way, I now have huge amounts of compassion for people who are shyer than me, because I'm not particularly shy, who are more timid, who are also struggling with that, because I am a strong-willed, loud personality who was still diminished, allowed himself to be diminished by the two business partners that he had. And I shrank. And so if I shrank as the super powerful, like, person who takes up a lot of space in a room, like I take up space when I'm in a room, like there's a strong energy body here. If I can shrink, and if I can like hold back my own capacity and be timid, I have so much compassion for people who are just naturally shy or timid, struggling to share their light. And I just hope that by sharing these stories that, you know, people can see, and not even see, but people are invited to consider a different path.
Yeah. Or just like living within your authenticity and the light that you are, I feel like is an example for other people.
Yes. And sharing it is permission.
Yeah.
Sharing it is permission.
Exactly. So because you have this platform, I want to give you an opportunity to share anything that you would like to, as far as a message to humanity or the world, or, you know, what you're up to next, or what you would like people to know about you, since you don't want to be in the basement anymore.
Well, I think you just did it for me in the last 5 minutes, to be honest with you. I mean, by asking about the Costa Rica, like what I learned in Costa Rica, that is definitely something that's important to me. And I hope that by sharing it, like I said, it gives people unconscious permission to be able to step into it themselves as well. In terms of sharing with humanity, gosh, I think that anytime, one of the reasons why I love having these conversations is that anytime you have a really good asker of questions and you have someone who's willing to show up and answer, that magic can exist in the room. And I feel like that's what we've been doing for this time together. And so I would say any message that I have for humanity is contained in the previous, whatever, 30 or 40 minutes of us talking. Really, yeah. Because I think the magic is in the asking and the answering. It's not me opining or having a monologue.
For sure. Yeah, I appreciate that. So what is your vision for Imloa? Like, where do you see it going?
I think for the first 4 or 5 years, I had really visioned it being stable and stabilized, because it's had so many challenges in its first few years. You know, I'd like to see it profitable. It is profitable for the last year and a half. We also brought it to profitability straight out of COVID, which was pretty extraordinary, first time in its history. But I think with profitability comes possibility. And the way we're geared to our 38-person or 40-person team is we create possibility. Our word creates our world, and we create possibility. And so I think profit can also help create that possibility for the families that we employ here in the town and in the different continents that we'll eventually expand into. So it's running a profitable, healthy company. It's opening a second profitable location. We have a lot of demand, as I suggested earlier. And so I think us finding a way to probably open a second location closer to us here in Costa Rica than maybe we expected. Maybe we expected to go to another continent right away. And it might make more sense as a leadership team to cultivate something a little bit more within an arm's length reach away. So that's in the immediate future, but really it's just running a profitable, healthy company that's contributing to the community that it calls home, that's contributing to its shareholders who have been so patient with us, that is creating this transformative experience for clients. We have 86% renewal rates for our retreat host that hosts here. Wow. I mean, that's incredible when you think about the fact that, you know, we're a little bit pricier than most, and our clients can host anywhere they damn well please in the world. And yet 86% of them keep coming back to Imaloa. Like, thank you so much. Like, that just, you know, that shows that we're on it, and we care a whole lot about what we're up to. So that's my immediate next vision. We'll see what the future holds. Lord knows, if you had asked me 5 years ago what the future holds, I would never have been able to even make up this story. So it's like, let me not future scape too much, and let me just stay as present as I can, and in service to people as much as I can, and as present with people as I can, and good, fun, interesting, dynamic, exciting things come from that place.
Yeah. So if listeners would like to learn more about you and Imaloa and what you guys are doing, where can we guide them to?
Well, I am off social media for a year, which is a damn miracle. So they can go to Imaloa's social media at imaloa.institute. And if they join us on any signature retreat and use the code word Jake at checkout, we'll give them $400 if they'd like to come on any signature retreat. And they can find out about the different retreats at imaloainstitute.com.
All right. Thank you so much. I'll add those into the show notes so people can click on them very
easily. It's nice if people are wanting to come to Costa Rica.
Yeah. It sounds like a good time to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I do have one last question that I like to ask to wrap up the conversation.
Sure.
And that is, if your inner voice had a billboard, what would it say to the world?
Oh my gosh, I have heard your podcast before. I just recognize, because you ask this to everybody.
I do.
And I literally listened to it, and I was like, what a question. I could never answer that if I had ever been asked that. Oh my God, I just recognized who you are. This is so much fun. Oh wow, that was a moment. If my inner voice could say, and I remember being so stumped, I had to pause it before I heard the guest's answer.
I mean, you can take your time because we can edit it out.
No, but this is part of the fun though. Now people can have a real moment with this. Okay. I don't think it's that technical of an answer. That's my initial thing. It's acceptance is the key. Is it one word or is it a sentence?
You know, whatever, lots of things can fit on a billboard. You just got to be creative. So, you know.
You know what? Acceptance, and I know I said it earlier, but acceptance is the key to all of my problems today. That when I can accept someone for who it is they are, or a situation for whatever it is, and not project on it, that life just becomes a little more serene. And it doesn't mean that the storm's not happening. Serenity to me is like being in the eye of the hurricane.
Yeah.
So acceptance is the key to all of my problems today.
All right. I like that. I like that. It reminds me of a saying, I don't know where it comes from. Acceptance of what happens is essential to the discovery of the truth.
Acceptance to what happens is essential to the discovery of the truth. Beautiful. I love that. Because I think deep down, authenticity, which you talk a lot about, and truth is actually what we're after. And in fact, I know we're at the end of the podcast, so you can edit this out if you want to, but I believe that I know for myself, when someone is authentic about how inauthentic they are, mm-hmm. I actually can get on with them very well. It's the people that I have trouble with at Imaloa, our clients, whatever, people who come in there inauthentic about how inauthentic they are. Because I think at the end of the day, we want people in our life. I want people in my life that show up authentically, even about how inauthentic we actually are. Cause all of us are.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
It's like, just be in that. And so I love this. Acceptance is the, hang on. Acceptance is, can you say it again, please?
Sure. Acceptance of what happens.
Acceptance of what happens.
Is essential to the discovery of the truth.
Of the truth. Yeah. Yeah. And authenticity and being authentic about how inauthentic. I think that that's so key because both are driving to truth. Yeah. And so is this podcast, by the way.
Yes. It's trying. It's what I'm trying to do.
Yes. Yes. I feel it. I feel it. And I love that. I feel like I just rediscovered you.
Yes. That was a cool moment for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for joining me on this podcast and sharing your time and your story and your wisdom and your
life. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the questions. Thank you for the discovery in my own life so that I can be led a little bit closer to truth.
Thank you so much for joining me this week. If you're listening and you like what you hear, please consider subscribing and rating this podcast, as it really helps get this podcast out to other people who might be interested in hearing it but don't know about it yet. And also, if you'd like to contact me or reach me, you can reach me at unconditioningpodcast@gmail.com or unconditioningpodcast on Instagram. Thank you so much, and until next time. Stay tuned in to you.